Let me tell you of the days of high adventure.
I'm Eric.
And I'm Kevin.
And this is 6 Degrees of Schwarzenegger, the podcast where we take a long, hard look at some of our favorite action movies from the era of Arnold.
Schwarzenegger is the icon of the genre, and we're taking a deep dive into some of these 80s and 90s cult action movies and breaking them all the way down.
Welcome back to episode 4 of Conan the Destroyer, Kevin.
Thank you, Eric. Yes, welcome back. We're delighted to be joined by a guest to take us the rest of the way on this adventure. It's my good friend, Kyle Pinion.
Hey. Glad to be back. Glad to be back.
Kyle joined us previously on our series on Masters of the Universe.
Oh, excellent.
So we bring you on. You're our barbarian guy.
Yeah. You know, this really gets back to my childhood of being obsessed with muscle men who carried swords.
Right.
I don't know how I turned out to be straight. I'm going to be honest.
I was thinking, like, this is what boys were like into in the 80s.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Big muscle dudes and like hot babes, but dudes wearing barely anything, like furry Speedos, you know, basically.
I had all of the He-Man action figures.
Me too.
All of them.
Yeah.
So,
me too.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And, you know, like Fire and Ice and, oh my God, what else? There's so many of those great old
Beastmaster.
Beastmaster is another amazing.
Yeah. Beastmaster, that's my
sorcery.
That's my set after the original Conan. Beastmaster is my favorite, like, barbarian movie, just as fun, a fun thing to watch and not terrible.
Yeah, I think Beastmaster is better, Kevin.
Than the first Arnold Conan?
I think so.
Okay.
Quick
admission. First time I ever saw the Arnold Conan was Kevin showing it to me here at this house.
Okay. I didn't want to out you like that.
Yeah, no, it's okay. It's okay.
And I mentioned on a previous episode having watched the first one with someone who had never seen it before. That was you.
That was me.
And I was I was amazed that sort of it moves along at a very slow, deliberate pace, the first one.
It's pretty boring.
And this one is like, I think it could have been the same, except they made it 30 minutes shorter.
Yeah.
And then you just cut those quiet moments out and keep it moving.
Yeah, I mean, my general take on the two Conan movies, now having seen them both, is that the first one, I think, gets the tone right.
Okay.
But gets the content wrong.
Mm.
When it comes to sort of like the original source material.
We're talking about the novels now.
Yeah,
the books, not the comics.
Well, yeah. I'm more specifically speaking about the Howard books. But
okay.
I think the sequel gets the content right, but the tone is all wrong. So neither one could get it exactly right in terms of their ingredients.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Like, first, your thoughts on these adaptations, but like, were the books or the comics, were they more of like a PG vibe or were they more of an R vibe?
Well, the books were as R as 1920s and 30s books could be. I mean, were there
rules back then?
Yeah.
I didn't know the books. I didn't know books had the same sort of.
Oh, you could get your books banned easily, right?
Okay. I mean, for just writing too explicit, but they were violent, but they weren't like graphic descriptions of violence?
Not necessarily. And I mean, there was a little bit of sexualized content too. Like, one of the things Robert Howard used to try to do was write so his book works, because they originally showed in like magazines and pulps and stuff.
Okay.
Sure.
And he wanted to always get the cover. And so the way you did that was writing about women getting spanked. And so there would always be some sort of bondage-y kind of scantily clad woman getting spanked by some evil man.
I've seen these covers, not Conan theme, but like just random ones where it'd be like a scantily clad woman getting like spanked by a Nazi or something. And it was like these pulp magazines from the 40s.
Or women
like
tied
that.
Up, you know,
yeah.
That's a big thing, you know. And
okay.
So they used what salaciousness they could that was still within the realms of seemingly good taste to get on these covers. So no, the books, I would say we're kind of closer to R-rated. The comics, very, very PG, if not even just G.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because the story, so the story for this movie was written by, who was the guy?
So Roy Thomas and Jerry Conway.
Roy Thomas, right. who invented Conan as a comic, right?
Yeah, like, well, yeah, he originated it. So this was one of the things I was going to probably bring up when we were talking about first half things that I missed.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a good segue because we obviously you're joining us midway. So before we move on, we wanted to hear what if you had any strong thoughts on the first half of the movie.
Well, you know, I think it's important to sort of highlight that Thomas Conway connection because in reality, those guys are the reason there are Conan movies in the first place. The whole reason behind that is because after Robert Howard killed himself in 1930, I think around 1930, 31. He died at the age of 30.
Had a lot of output.
Yeah.
As a young man.
Yeah.
That's very, great.
Incredibly influential for a guy who is much younger, who died much younger than anyone at the table, I'm assuming. Conan kind of languished for some time. And it wasn't until the novels were reissued in the 50s and then more specifically in the 60s with the cover art of a guy named Frank Frazetta.
Frazetta. Yeah, that's classic.
I know.
And love Frazetta.
Well, and the thing about it is prior to Frazetta, Conan looked kind of like just your standard old gladiator.
Was he muscle bound? Was he known for his strength?
Muscle bound. Well, yeah, I mean, in the stories, yes.
Yeah,
but the actual art that accompanied the stories, that sold the stories, I mean, he kind of looked like Harry Houdini or something, you know, but in like Roman cosplay. It wasn't like, so Frazetta is what turned him into the barbarian archetype that we know now.
Okay.
And so using that, that became sort of the thing that sold Conan and revitalized him in the 60s. That led to Marvel licensing that work as a ongoing series of comic books written by Roy Thomas, who prior to that was best known as Stan Lee's number one protege. And like basically he was the editor in chief who followed Stan after Stan had stepped down to kind of pursue Hollywood dreams. And Jerry Conway was kind of like his protege. He came into comics at like 17, 18.
Okay.
And so those guys worked on Conan. Conan became like the most successful comic of the 70s for Marvel. And
they created Red Sonja as a comic
as
well?
They did, okay. Yeah. Using some raw material from Robert Howard and then just the need for a female barbarian.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We all have a need for a female barbarian.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because those comics and that Frazetta art is what sold the producers on creating the first Conan movie.
Absolutely. Well, they probably made it a lot more visually appealing and striking and different than
the books.
Than anyone had seen before, including like the existence of people with these physiques.
Yeah.
Because I don't think until steroids were around, like guys weren't that big and also like sort of chiseled looking.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever it was. You had your Tarzan and stuff who were strong guys, but they looked like those dudes who'd be wearing like a one piece bathing suit, you know,
like old lifting boxers.
Like throwing a barrel, a barrel over their head at the beach or
weights.
Right. Those bowling pin.
Right.
Yeah. Those bowling pin things that they did.
Like, with 100 pounds written on them, right? You know?
Absolutely. It was a barbell with like two big round spheres on the end.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. With the big handlebar mustaches and they're always bald too.
Now, But was Conan, in either of the comics or the books, was he like a renowned thief? Was that his, that was his thing? Okay, we weren't sure if that was like, he's a famous thief. He's like a Robin Hood type character.
Yeah. Well, he's got different eras. I mean, he starts out as a thief, then he becomes sort of a known barbarian, and then he eventually becomes the king of Aquilonia.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He's even a pirate somewhere in the middle.
That's rad.
One of his other great love interests is Belit, the queen of the seas or whatever her name is.
I was just wondering, like, he seemed like, he's a famous thief, but I wasn't sure how true that was to source material
or
whatever. Okay, dope.
Very cool.
Well, I'm super pumped that he's joining us at this moment because this, to me, this next like 10 minutes or so, I think is the strongest 10 minutes of the movie for me.
Yeah.
I don't know what the tone's supposed to be. I wish you all could see Kyle's eyebrows are very raised right now. I love this when they seem to get the comic tone where I want my comic tone to be.
Well, Kevin, why don't you remind us a little bit of what's happened up to this point in the movie? Can you sum it up a little bit for us?
Yeah. So basically what's going on is Conan is this known thief character. So his new sidekick is this guy named Malik. He and Malik get scooped up by the evil queen Taramis, and he's seduced into going on a quest for her with the promise that he'll get his ancient, his long lost dead love, Valeria, back, who was his love interest from the first film. So their mission is to escort the queen's niece, the Princess Jenna, to collect MacGuffin number one so that they can then go and collect MacGuffin number two. Mm-hmm. And then bring her back for reasons unknown. They're also accompanied by the head of the queen's guard, this Wilt Chamberlain, towering dude, Bombada.
Yeah, the horse's banes all over the world. Every horse hates Bombada. Yeah,
he's like dragging his feet a lot. Right now. But unbeknownst to Conan, there's a side, there's a betrayal coming because the queen's ordered Bombada, once we get that first MacGuffin, I've got some other goons that are coming and we want to kill Conan. Mm-hmm. And so your mission, Bombada, is to then get the second MacGuffin and bring the princess back. She's got to be a virgin because we're going to kill her. And we're doing some sort of scheme to bring this old ancient god back to life. So along the way, they pick up a wizard named Akiro, who was the wizard in the first movie, and a warrior woman named Zula. And I think they've just collected the first MacGuffin from the wizard Tathamon, the giant diamond.
That is correct.
The queen's goons descended on him and tried to kill Conan and take the princess, but they failed. All the goons got killed. Everyone should be well aware that Bombada is like in league with some plan at this point, but everyone's just seems willing to go along with it.
Yeah.
So I think now they're getting really shit-faced and celebrating their first little victory of the quest.
Indeed. That was an excellent summary. I could not have done it better, quite frankly. So as we pick up after that point, it's that night and we see Bombada sharpening his sword very, very kind of menacingly, honestly.
Oh yeah.
And Jenna examines the jewel and Conan is just bombed out of his mind. I mean, just as drunk as you could possibly get, Conan is there.
Which that was recurring from the first film that Conan loved to drink. Was that a thing that was true in the books and comics?
He's a hard drinker, hard partier. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
That's good. I like that. That's canon.
Yeah. I'm just staying true to the source material. Malik is doing what he can to get in good with Zula. And he's rubbing some balm or a wizard potion on her inner thigh, which is good on him to just like go for it like that. But
sure.
As he's doing it, he works his way higher and higher and higher. She totally calls him on it. And he tries to play it off, saying, "We don't want the infection to spread," which is, all right, okay, yeah.
Kyle, did you recognize this guy?
Yeah, Bob the Goon.
Bob the Goon.
He'll always be Bob the Goon for me, no matter how many bad movies I see him in.
I think those are the two things I've ever really seen him in myself.
I always see him in a random B-movie role. Okay. You know, I used to always mix him up with that other guy from Deadwood, the guy that ran the hotel.
Oh, Sanderson?
So, I mean, those two actors, they're so close in type for me. Definitely. I would like to point out very quickly, I still don't know why they added this sidekick. I can't, for the whole movie, I do not know why they added.
I have a theory.
The most unfunny comic relief you could possibly add.
He has
one joke lands.
He has one. No, later on he has one good moment later on, the brother, sister's cousin or whatever. That's funny to me, but we'll get there. But I think you just have to, he has to have a cowardly sidekick to accentuate how brave Conan is. Right. But I think they wanted Subutai, his sidekick from the first film, back. For whatever reason, that didn't happen. And so now he's got this guy.
Well, it's too big a group anyway, is what I'm going to say. It's a huge ensemble, and some people don't get things to do. That's my biggest criticism.
That's also
true.
What
do you mean? He's rubbing the balm on the inside of his thigh. He's got plenty to do.
He's making moves.
I mean, he's better off than poor old Akiro.
That is true.
Akiro's a big hero moment.
I mean, he tries to
something. Desired later.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing when he tries to break open the glass from earlier and he's like, "I can't do anything." And you're like, "Why did we bring you along exactly?" Anyway, Jenna moseys over and she applies some balm on the gashes of Conan's enormous biceps. And she says, I suppose nothing hurts you. And Conan says, quite eloquently, only pain. Mm. Which
that's a strong line.
It's a strong line.
That's a good tough guy line, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a good line.
Yeah.
He is wasted. There is no question about this.
I just question the wisdom of getting that bombed around someone who you suspect is trying to kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Conan's pretty fearless, I guess.
I don't think Conan, I mean, he's a great thief. He's a great fighter. He's built. No one has ever accused him of being an amazing strategist. He's not thinking ahead, you know? He sees booze, he's going to take the booze.
Yeah.
So Jenna asks him what he's going to do once he gets her back home, and he says he's going to find his own kingdom and a queen to sit beside him. She seems a little bit pissed off to hear this, asking what kingdom, and he goes, the promise I was kingdomed. No, the kingdom I was promised. Schwarzenegger doing his best drunk impersonation.
I actually buy him as a
really?
Drunk. I thought this. I was working for me more than anything else he's done in the movie up until now. He gives great drunk face.
Yeah, he does.
He looks drunk. Maybe he was. I don't know, but
yeah,
wishful thinking made him method actor. Got to get bombed. Bring me the schnapps.
So she asks him, "What queen?" And he proudly says Valeria. And Jenna asks what Valeria was like. And Conan says she was like Zula, not in appearance, but in spirit, in strength, which, okay. Conan says that Valeria was a great warrior and a great woman. And Jenna keeps with these line of questioning. I mean, just laying it on real thick here.
It reminded me of the bit in Red Dawn where somehow, like, hearing about how much this guy loves this other woman gets her hotter and hotter.
Yeah, it's a really similar vibe. I wonder if Milius's sort of handprint here, even though Milius didn't ultimately direct it, if his influence...
Maybe.
Anyway, so Jenna says, could there be anyone else but her? And Conan responds, another queen, lot on your knife. Not on your life. Another great line.
Arnold's bringing it for me in this scene.
He's nailing it.
He was not a polished actor by any stretch, like at this point in his career, and this was kind of working for me.
But Jenna looks deeply wounded at this point, and Conan says he must get up now, and then keels over.
I dug the comedy, the timing, and everything of that. Like, I'm going to go over here now, and then just passes out, like blacks out.
It was a great
out.
Scene. Yeah, it was a totally great scene.
So I also like the idea of, I would love just a movie where the hero was drunk the entire movie. Mm-hmm. Like, while they're doing all of their heroics, they're just hammered.
I mean, like, he's not drunk for the whole movie, but Drunken Master is amazing if you've never seen that.
And so it's not just drunken boxing style. It's like he's also literally drunk?
Yes. No. The only way he can beat the bad guy is by getting progressively drunker. And the ultimate fight sequence is an absolute classic. Because he gets better and better at the fight the drunker and drunker he gets. And so all of these Drunken Master characters you've seen in other movies and in fighting games as well, all inspired by that movie, in my opinion.
Is that Jackie?
It is. Jackie Chan. Young Jackie Chan.
Kyle's a big Jackie Chan
guy. Yeah, yeah. You know, that second Drunken Master is probably one of his better films, right?
Really?
Like Police Story. Mm-hmm. There's the last 20 minutes of Drunken Master 2. Ooh, man.
You've
never seen a fight like that before.
Okay. I gotta get on my Hong Kong.
Oh, yeah. Jackie Chan in his prime, no one can match him. Just unbelievable. Anyway, Jenna wanders over to Zula and begins to ask her a bunch of questions. She says she didn't know women could be warriors, and Zula says her whole tribe was. Jenna also then says that men like women warriors, and Zula confirms that some do. Some good back and forth, you know, highly dynamic dialogue going on here.
Jenna's got a one-track mind, though.
Yeah,
like, she just wants
deeply.
To bed Conan.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I love her commitment to the bit, though. You know, like, if I have to be a warrior to get him in the sack, then I'm going to go all in on it. So
this movie needed Zula, right? Like, she's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, Grace Jones is, like, probably giving the most committed performance of the entire film.
That's what I feel the same way. And first of all, you need a badass woman in the company, right?
Of course.
And like you said, Grace Jones is, like, bringing intensity to it more so than everyone else who just seems like they just want to be done with the day and go to the restaurant or whatever, right?
Well, we were talking about it in the earlier episode, but in the scene where they rescue her or rescue her, I guess. I don't think she needed to be rescued. She broke two of the stuntmen's like jaws or something. I mean, it was crazy. She got really into it.
Wow.
So Zula begins to train Jenna on how to fight with her bow staff. Meanwhile, Conan stirs from his slumber, takes another huge gulp of booze. Just to see what's going on.
That I love that we woke up from being blacked out just for more, just for more drink.
Hair the dog, man.
I feel like we've all been there at least one time.
Yeah. Sure.
Anyway, Conan stops his training session and he tells Jenna to learn to fight with a real weapon, also known as a sword.
A little dismissive.
Yeah. Not a toothpick, as he calls her bow staff. He helps her swing the sword over her head and then she proceeds to whack Malik hard with it.
So I feel like that would crack your skull.
Oh, he'd be
like
dead.
Even if he did not get hit with the sharp part of the blade, that was like a heavy ass sword, right? Like she couldn't even lift the weight of it.
No, she couldn't even lift it up. And Conan tells her that she's ready to take on anybody, and then probably walks face first into a brick wall that is Bombada, and then he passes out on the ground. I mean, it is still impressive to see that photo of Schwarzenegger standing next to Will Chamberlain.
I know.
And yeah. Timberland towering over him.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So I thought they struck a good tone of comedy here. That actually, at least some of the jokes made me laugh. You, Kyle, you did not, no. You weren't loving any of this?
No.
No parts of it?
No, okay. Man. It tonally, it's just, this movie's kind of a wreck. But yeah, its reaches for sort of guffaws really, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like, it's like Kevin James style humor before Kevin James happened, you know.
Sure.
But I will say, like, a big part of it is that I think the movie just, like, it lacks focus. Like, you yeah. know, one of the problems, you guys were talking about two different MacGuffins. Two MacGuffins in a movie. Who does that? You know,
and it's still in a 90-minute movie.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a gigantic ensemble plus Tom Cruise
Mission Impossible movies do that in like a 2.5-hour movie. It might be like, we got to go on the one impossible quest to then go on the next quest.
Well, those are well-made films. Yeah. This is not.
What? Take that back.
Some of the cinematography is like really impressive.
There is some good stuff, but that's when you're letting like the landscape do some heavy lifting.
Yeah.
That's not the film. That's not like just because, what a great filmmaker to he pointed the camera at the mountains.
The best actor was the landscape.
Yeah. And whoever built those models, the force perspective, the foreground miniatures.
Yeah.
There's good sword play. I was admiring that. Okay. We'll get there.
And Conan's muscles are amazing.
Wow.
That's true.
So
primordial.
So the next day, the company is riding through some, I don't know, desert-like landscapes, and Jenna asks Zulu how to attract a man. She is just not going to let up on this. And Zulu says, grab him and take him, which I am completely on board for. I just want to get that out in the open. Ladies, if you want me, all you got to do is grab me.
That's a big feminist energy. I was digging it. I like that.
Jenna rides ahead, and then she asks Malik what Zula means by grabbing a man and taking him.
I mentioned earlier, this was one of those scenes where I felt like Olivia Dabo was like bringing a lot of swagger and confidence to her performance, way more so than I would expect from a literal child.
Yeah,
that she was, because she just was. I was shocked when you told me about her winning the Razzies.
Yeah,
because I'm like, oh, I thought she was as good of an actor as any other person in this movie. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, Grace Jones aside, and maybe Sarah Douglas aside, you know, Sarah Douglas, the Olivia Colman of shitty movies.
I don't know her from, except from this in Superman, Superman 1 and 2.
That's all you needed. That's all you needed.
Yeah, she throws down. Yes, that's Ursa, that's hot.
I mean, hey, her costumes are pretty epic in Destroyer. I'm just going to say, just shut that out there. But, so Malik attempts to give her the worst birds and the bees conversation you've ever had. I mean, I think my parents actually did a better job. And it's a really low bar. But anyway, he says that men and women must, quote unquote, join to really get to know each other.
This bit I thought was funny. I was buying Bob the Goon.
I'll go with it. I'll go with it, Kevin.
So he quote, has to take his and grab her by the... There, you are joined. I mean, How do you think flowers grow?
He was, join. He has a weird delivery to the whispery sort of thing all the time.
Yeah.
There you are. Joined.
I love how an uncouth thief is like worried about the moral integrity of a 14-year-old, by the
way.
That's
the thing. I think maybe she is supposed to be 14, the character. This has been an ongoing debate in my head. Like, how old is Jenna supposed to be?
I mean, I don't think anyone much older would have still been a virgin, just to be honest.
I mean, in this day and age, honestly, 14-year-olds were probably had kids already back in this day and age.
Fair.
But, they're treating her like she's a child. Like, he's embarrassed to get graphic with her or anything like that.
I appreciate the fact that even a thief has a sense of propriety, though.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, props to that.
Yeah.
So they reach a very narrow pass, and Jenna says that this is the only way through. So they hop off their horses, and they head into what is obviously not a good situation.
Yeah. I wonder what the weather is supposed to be where they are, because half the characters are almost naked, and then the other half are head to toe in fur. I'm like, somebody's either really hot or really cold, I feel like. I don't know. That throws me when it's like, Zula's wearing nothing.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say,
Conan's wearing almost nothing.
But I don't buy that there was no other way around that pass. I mean, come on, please.
They're letting Jenna lead the way because she claims, she doesn't know the way. It's just like coming to her.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's sort of established that it's like an impression that she's getting because of her destiny.
Okay.
Yeah. So
it works.
Yeah. I mean, whatever.
All's well that ends well.
I don't think anybody is awarding this movie an Academy Award for best screenplay. On the other side, they find a castle that is built into the cliffs,
which was another amazing matte painting or forced perspective or set.
Yeah.
That they built, because that was pretty epic.
I mean, I will say this, say what you want about everything else about this movie, but the sets and the special effects, especially about large structures and things like that, perfect.
The costumes were like top notch.
The costumes were amazing.
I'm always a sucker for sets that look like they could be from Legends of the Hidden Temple.
Yeah.
I'm always kind of into that, because a movie like this feels like a precursor to like those Kevin Sorbo Hercules shows.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Even to the point where Malik kind of reminds me of like every character Ted Raimi would eventually play. Yeah. So
Jockster?
Yeah.
Jockster.
It's big Jockster energy. Yeah.
So they approach the large stone doors that are in front of this large castle. He pushes them open. They enter. And again, Jenna just knows the way. It's never explained why. We just assume that it's some sort of magic.
Then they let her go out in front of everyone else, which seems very unsafe to do.
I mean,
like, to let her lead the way. Like, I get that she knows the way, but you would have Conan or Bombada walking out front.
This is before child labor laws, so.
Fair. They always let Conan do all the heavy lifting, too, don't they? They're like, Conan, by yourself, go push that door open.
In all fairness, I'm in the middle of a D&D campaign, and I play as a barbarian, and everybody's always nominating me to walk through doors first.
They sit back and watch while you risk your life.
Oh, yeah, every time. And I'm happy to do it, as a barbarian would be. So they advance into the darkness. Conan finds a torch. Akito ignites it with some magic. Finally, he's done something.
That was a pretty cool practical effect, too. I don't know how they did that. It was just really did burst into flames. I liked it.
So they keep wandering into the castle. Zula gets scared of a rat, of all things, and screams and then immediately tries to murder it. And they give her a puzzled look, and she just shrugs.
Like, that was nice. Nice work from Grace there.
Yeah.
She's charming.
All ladies are scared of rats.
Apparently.
It seems. no matter what your culture is.
So what I had read was they said the first movie was like an attempt at this mythic, epic storytelling.
Yeah.
And then they said, for the sequel, let's change it to just be like a family-friendly sort of jaunty adventure tone.
Oh, yeah. And you can feel it.
But this stretch, I feel like, has hit the mark of trying to do the jaunty, lighthearted, family-friendly adventure sort of thing. Other than the heavy sexual innuendo, trying to put the cream on Zula, and then the 14-year-old trying to mount Conan.
Again, they keep wandering deeper and deeper into the darkness, and Malik starts to wonder if someone shouldn't stay behind and perhaps stand guard. They reach another massive stone door, and then Conan and Bombada, they use their combined strength.
It's too heavy. Too heavy for Conan by himself.
I love that. I love that shit. Picking up a heavy door. Love it.
Well, it makes you wonder, how did the people... How does anyone else open this door?
Right, exactly.
Is there like a lever somewhere or a key or a crank or something that they just don't know about?
There was a series of pulleys just out of frame that no one bothered to look for.
What about at the end of Malik's like, let me help? And runs in once they've got it up, you know? He's like, yeah, that's good.
Yes. So, yeah. So, exactly. Malik looks for a lever to lock the door up, and then they move through into the next room, which is this massive crypt with torches everywhere and jewels covering every surface.
Another amazing set, right?
Yeah, again.
They're building amazing sets that are on screen for like 3 or 4 minutes.
I know. It's just a different world. I mean, if it was a Marvel movie, that would all be green screen, right?
I read where a lot of these sets were then reused in Dune.
Oh, cool.
In De Laurentiis' Dune that came out later. And yeah. I don't have much experience with that movie, but I was like, oh, that makes sense. Yeah. I guess if you can just redress it and...
Yeah,
and save some money.
It's not very good, but it has some interesting visual touches.
Now that I've seen both Dunes, I'm gonna watch, because that one tells the story of both of the first two movies, new movies.
Yeah. Yes. It rushes the climax very quickly.
Okay, I'm gonna get into it because I'm a David Lynch guy. I started watching it earlier today, and I'm like, it's weird to see all these David Lynch actors in this movie that doesn't feel Lynchy at all, really, other than the dream sequences are trippy.
Yeah. Yeah. Having Big Ed from Twin Peaks playing Stilgar.
Oh my God.
Okay.
I mean, honestly, they could have done a lot worse than Comic Lachlan as Paul Atreides.
Oh, I know. Yeah. For sure.
But Patrick Stewart, you know, in an early role, which is crazy.
With his pugs that he has. you'll see.
So is that more true to the books, that some of the weird touches that are in the Lynch?
No, that was pure Lynch, man. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
it's a longer discussion.
Oh my God. Yeah, we'll talk about
that. That is a whole other podcast that we are not doing right now.
Fair.
So the jewels are encrusting all of the walls, and Malik pops one off and swallows it, of all
things.
That's
his thing.
Yeah, he does.
I told him earlier, I want the director's cut where we get long sequences of Malik fishing through his own shit, like trying to get the jewels back.
See, that would be funny. That would be
deleted scene.
That would be so good.
That would be like a Joss Whedon post-credit scene. It's just Malik rooting through shit. So Akito reads hieroglyphs on the walls, and it's the same prophecy that Queen Taramis tells us about her daughter, you know, with the prophecy and all the marks and everything, and then the horn and all that nonsense. You have to be reminded. Otherwise, we might forget in this 90-minute long movie.
Well, it's the birthmark that has no... It's never even acknowledged or mentioned or shown, other than maybe in this next little shot. It seemed like she had a mark on her chest, which might have been a bigger role. If I realized, why do we put the birthmark on like the chest of a 14-year-old girl?
they definitely like suddenly realize, oh, we never showed this birthmark at all.
Yeah. So the people at Universal were like, yeah, you can't have the 14-year-old like whip her breast out to reveal the birthmark. We got to cut around that.
Jenna, she produces the key again, and she approaches the lock, which is, you know, it's fine. It's a magical lock. It doesn't need a key-shaped key. But oh no, wait, there's more to the prophecy. And Akito continues to read. And he says, "And when the horn is placed once more in the forehead of the dreaming god, Dagoth will arise. Then let men fear. Death to the world. The woman child will be sacrificed." So Dagoth, and we talked about this in an earlier episode, is an actual old Zoroastrian god.
Yeah, this one seemed like they tried to pull some from some real history, more so than the first movie, which just made up, I think, its own mythology.
I guess. I don't know that much about Zoroastrianism. I'm going to say yes. You're not sure.
So Jenna approaches the lock, and she places the jewel into it, and then the jewel glows a bright red. Akito yells out for them to stop what they're doing, but Conan shushes him.
They're going crazy with the star filter.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Did the star filter bother you, Kyle?
No.
They went wild with it the whole second half of the movie. Like almost any shot that Jenna's in, it was like, put that star filter on. That's our motif.
Rather than Vaselining up the lenses to give her the soft focus, just get that star filter going.
Absolutely.
So a large door that looks like a monster it opens its maw and there's this wall of flames inside its maw.
I love this type of shit, man. Yeah, like Indiana Jones feeling stuff. Yeah. Like you said, sort of hidden temple, big Beastmaster vibes too.
Huge.
And again, it's just like, it's all practical, right? I mean, it's just like that thing is there. They built that for that moment. You know, it's really cool. So Jenna, all of a sudden, she's in a trance and she just walks into the flames.
Yeah.
And Conan, of course, evokes Crom at this point, which is great.
Yeah.
Actually, I use Crom's name in vain instead of God's name. Oh, okay. It's great. It's amazing.
It's excellent.
So inside the inner chamber, they all follow her in, and inside the inner chamber, Jenna finds the jewel-encrusted horn that we've been promised since the very beginning of the movie, and the flames completely die down. She walks out with a horn and she gives it back to Bombada for safekeeping, who everybody in the theater at this point is going, why are you doing this? So at that point, Akito finishes off the prophecy, death to the world. And then Conan responds, life for Valeria, which I thought was a good call and answer moment.
Yeah, he's blinded, right, by his desire to be. That's why he's overlooking all of the shady shit, I guess, that's been going on. I kind of buy it, though. I like that. I said a lot in the earlier episodes, I like that his motivation is like, it's not just I'm a hero, so I got to go on the adventure. It's more like I want to be reunited with my soulmate or whatever Valeria was to him, like his one great love. I dig it.
I mean, he's got a motivation, right? He's got a purpose for going on the journey, which is always the hardest part about a wanderer like Conan, right? Like, how do you keep him motivated going on this path with these other characters? So anyway, Akita tells Conan that Jenna's destiny isn't to deliver the horn, but to be sacrificed ultimately. And Conan then goes, we shall see. Another great line. I mean, Conan's got a couple of like good moment lines here.
We shall see is becoming like a little bit of a catchphrase for Conan. I mean, he said that after Grace Jones's character was going to join them. You know, he just keeps returning to it.
Which is sort of passive. Right for your hero, just to be like, well, let's kick back and see how it all plays out.
Oh,
anyway, no,
passivity.
He suddenly senses, he senses the danger.
Yeah.
Apparently.
So they get back to the entrance of the cave and they're surrounded by a bunch of guys in the most epic BDSM gear ever seen.
It's like a GIMP army.
It was ridiculous the amount of leather that was in this scene.
I got to know, like, what do they do the other 364 days of the year that no one comes to try to like steal the horn or
it's
whatever.
Like, it's like cruising over there. Hanky code.
Or they're just working on their leather. I mean, you got to keep that stuff oiled.
Oiling.
You
know?
Oh, yeah,
constantly
exactly.
Oiling.
Just constantly keeping it nice and supple. An old guy steps forward and says that they come in peace. And then Conan shouts, then let us go in peace, which I think is another.
There's like a logic to that.
Yeah.
I like that. Good point.
So the old guy asks Jenna to step forward because they've been waiting for her their entire lives in between sex orgies. He says that they are the keeper of the horn.
That's a great name for your like sex cult. We're the keepers of the horn.
Keeper of the horn.
Oh, where do you keep it?
Well, do you have an hour? We'll show you. So they say that they're keepers of the horn, and then Conan retorts, not anymore. The older guy.
It's unclear what the keepers of the horn want.
Right.
No.
Don't they want the same thing, I think, is which is to see Jenna deliver the horn to the Dagoth statue.
Exactly.
I think so. It's sort of strange. It's not, they don't want her. They don't seem to want to keep her from stealing it.
Kevin, are you trying to tell me the script isn't airtight? Are you telling me that?
Like, it made sense in Last Crusade, right? Where he's like trying to protect the Grail and he's here to fight whoever might try to take it. Yeah. These guys are like, we just want to look at her. We just bring her out. We've been waiting for this day. But they want the horn to make it to the statue.
They do.
I think she's the only one who can do it.
Right. Yeah. They've been waiting for her, haven't they? I mean,
I feel like it.
So they ask who they're talking to, and Conan says that it's Conan that you're talking to. And clearly his reputation has preceded him.
So Conan, in the books and all that, he's a famous figure in the world.
Increasingly so. Yeah. I mean, he starts off not so, but yes.
Well, yeah, he's a slave, becomes a thief, becomes a barbarian becomes a king.
Yeah.
Pirate with a pirate.
Pirate's in there. Don't forget the pirate part. Very important. Those are good stories. Conan the pirate. Black Coast. It's very good.
Conan the Pirate. That's the movie I was waiting for. It never happened.
No.
So Akito steps forward and he asks them, the BDSM cult, about the prophecy. And the old guy who's in charge says that when the horn is placed on the forehead of Dagoth, he will live again, and those loyal to him will sit at his side and rule the world with him. So Akito says that they will all die, countering his point, and the leader is convinced that they will be able to control this elder god, though. He's absolutely convinced of it.
Right, so they want it to happen, right? I think.
Well, yeah, because they want to control him, right? Like, they're going to rule the world through this god who is their slave.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, sure.
Which famously always works out.
We'll just control him.
We'll
control him.
I'm going to be honest. When that guy showed up with all the leather gimps, I thought it was the other old guy that was with Sarah Douglas.
I got notes on that later. When we get back to the courtyard or whatever. Yeah, let's talk about it, because I got extensive notes. Like, that's the same guy.
So Akito counters their claim that they're going to be able to control Dagoth, saying that there's no way. He's too powerful and too evil to control. The leather-bound antagonists demand that they hand over Jenna, or they will take her by force. Enough talk, Conan screams. And throws a knife right into the nearest guy's gut.
I love just that moment.
Right to violence.
That's a great action movie moment, and a great, like, the most quintessentially Arnold moment of the movie, right? Enough talk. Whips that knife. I feel like that moment, and then maybe some of the sword play, are the only clips from this movie that make it into, like, Arnold highlight reels.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know?
But definitely enough talk. Let's start killing. Let's cut to the killing.
The knife in the gut was the green light to go, and the fight is on, and they're doing a pretty good job of defending against the leather cloud bad guys, but they're still severely outnumbered, and Conan tells everybody to retreat back into the crypt. Conan and Bambata hold the attackers at bay while everybody's getting inside. They kill a bunch of dudes. I mean, Will Chamberlain owns it in this scene. I mean, he really looks violent in this moment.
And the movie got very bloody again.
Yeah.
Eric was saying, I think they started filming it with the idea that it was going to be an R-rated movie. Mm. And then somewhere in the production, they decided to make it a PG. And I feel like these very bloody battles must have probably already been shot or something, because this is bloody shit that's happening, like spatter and heads flying off and stuff.
So Conan yells to Bambata to get into the crypt. Bambata heads in, pulls the lever to release the door, and then it seems like he's trying to trap Conan outside
right
at this moment. But Conan manages to roll under the door Indiana Jones style right before it closes.
And actually, it was clearly like run in reverse. Right?
Yeah. Oh my God.
They were running the film backwards.
I also like that Conan clearly had no suspicion about Bambata at that
point.
Yeah. He just had to close the door.
So a bunch of guys try to lift the door, have no success doing this. And then the leader of the BDSM army tells everybody to get out of the way, and he starts like doing weird hand gestures.
Did you like his sign language that he's got, like his communication with the guys, like these weird, and like he'd hit his gauntlets together or something. It's like a bicycle bell, like
I want to believe that they actually like got a linguist to develop the sign language.
It's
just
fully
for this
formed
one scene. Yeah, exactly. It requires that you have metal gauntlets before you can speak it.
I'm not going to lie. I was checking to make sure I didn't get like texts when the chime went off. It sounds exactly like my phone.
So Conan tells Jenna to grab the key, and then they head farther into the tunnel. Meanwhile, the leader guy from the army, he apparently could do it. Like his whatever sign language he's using, it opens the door.
He's got the magic touch or whatever, I guess.
And as the door opens, Conan is rushing everybody out. Malik is bringing up the rear, and he grabs one more jewel just to go.
For the road.
Why not? The door begins to close again, but the army pours in, and they start just forcing it open by their sheer strength of will. Conan acknowledges that the leader has to be a wizard of some kind, which, okay, yeah, I think we figured that out at this point. They argue over who should kill the wizard.
It's bad luck to kill a wizard, says our guy. Yeah, not funny.
Yeah.
But, you know, is it bad? Why not? Sure. I guess it's bad luck to kill a wizard.
I don't know. I mean, is that a thing?
It's like, never been established. No, I mean,
I've never heard that ever in any fantasy work I've ever read.
Growing up, my mom always used to tell me, don't walk under ladders, don't see black cats, and don't kill wizards. Yeah. I mean, those are the three every time. Anyway, Akita steps forward and he says he knows how to handle the situation. And so they begin to have a magic duel. Akito doing something again, I guess.
Yeah. Was it Big Trouble in Little China vibes?
Yeah.
With like the wizard off.
Yeah, you know, I just don't understand the rules of magic in this this Conan world. It's just guys staring at one another.
Yeah, they needed effects here, right?
Yeah, like a beam or something, you know, right? some sort of like magic spell chant or something. You know,
because Akira just crosses his eyes, and that's like magic's happening now.
Yeah,
the other dude was like exhaling, he's puffing smoke out of his mouth.
They were scannering each other. I mean, it's basically what it was.
But nobody's head popped, right. Unfortunately. So Akito wins, and the wizard drops the door, and it crashes closed. So through just nothing but torchlight, they travel through these dark tunnels. At some point, someone seems to lose a part of their outfit once it gets snagged on something.
Which was Jenna, like her fur got snagged, and they're just like, just leave it.
Is that relevant? Does that become relevant again later?
It's relevant to me.
Oh, okay.
Because why did it even happen?
Okay.
I got that too.
Okay. All right, cool. Okay.
And it served no narrative purpose, though, at all. Well, I thought there must have been a deleted scene, right? Where Conan would later, which way do we go? And then they see the fur there.
Clearly. That makes sense.
But they cut that out. So it's like, you could have cut the part with her losing the fur. But then I guess... then they're wondering, why does she not have her cloak on or whatever the next scene.
Right. I'm telling you, Dick Fleischer did not care. There was a point where he was just like, whatever.
So Bobata urges Jenna to go in front of him. And then
she sprints off into total darkness. No torch.
I mean, when has Jenna at any point during this movie acted in any sort of logical fashion? Honestly, watching it, I'm like, yeah, okay, that tracks.
Yeah. She does what Bombata says. I mean, that's been her whole life, I suppose.
Right, exactly. So as soon as she does that, Bombata finally going beyond the pale and proving that he is evil causes a cave-in that traps Conan, Zula, Akito, and Malik in the tunnel. So Bombata leads Jenna out, and they see a shaft of sunlight, and they smash through that hole, and they emerge from the caves.
Right next to the horses.
Yeah, conveniently enough.
Incredibly convenient. So, well, our lazy screenwriting. What if the horses are just right there?
The thing that I love the most about it is they don't even address it. They're like fully expected the horses to be on the other side of
the other side of a mountain or something, right? Like, oh, sweet.
So Will Chamberlain practically one-hands Jenna up onto the horse.
Every time he picks her up like she's a Barbie doll or something, just like he just grabs her and like
doesn't even think about
puts her on top of a horse. It's crazy to me.
Unbelievable. So Jenna asks where the others are, and he says that they're coming, and then he sends her on her way. While that's going on, Conan is trying to, you know, remove all the rocks from the cave-in enough that people can squeeze through. But before they can get out, Jenna and Bombata ride off. They move just in time, or they move just not in time, and speculate that the two of them have either fled or been captured at this point.
I'm really wondering why Bombata wouldn't have taken their horses, or scattered their horses, or killed their horses.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, the only way they could ever catch up with you is if you leave the horses for them. But movies, I don't think, like, they don't like to have the characters kill animals. Well, I feel like in the real world, horses, like, all the time, if you're fighting in a battle, like, shoot your arrow, and if you hit their horse, that's great.
Yeah,
right. Like, and in movies, it's like, we can kill all the people we want, just we can't have our characters hurting animals, because then they're that'd be making them bad people, right?
He could punch them though.
That's true, Conan.
I will say, in this instance, I think it was just lazy writing.
Yeah.
I feel like someone was like, well, if the horses run off, how do they get back to the castle?
They need a shortcut.
We'd have to figure that out. Well, I don't want to do the work. So finally, Conan seems to have known all along that Bombata and Queen Taramis have been planning this from the beginning.
The wool has been, has been pulled away or whatever.
Exactly,
the veil has been pulled away.
And she didn't care whether they lived or die after they got the horn. And Akira asks about Termis's promise to Conan, and he just responds, a lie. The truth has become clear.
His eyes are open. He's blinded by desire. Now he's pissed, though.
Conan jumps on his horse. Malak asks where he's going. And Conan says he's going to go stop Jenna from being sacrificed.
I think the unspoken part is, and kill everyone.
Everybody. So Malak says, but it's her destiny and it can't be stopped. And Conan says, well, you're fine.
Did he bust out a We Shall See again? That would have been like the
trifecta. Been like, yeah, that would have been perfect.
I don't think he did, though.
I don't remember that
he sort of tells him, I think he's like, you guys don't have to come with me.
Yeah.
Sort of thing, which is a good, that's your hero moment.
Yeah.
We had that, the same thing in the first Conan where he's like, well, I'm going to try to fight Thulsa Doom. You guys don't have to come with me.
Mm, yeah.
Like,
it's only my responsibility.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
So Akira and Zula immediately volunteer. Malak doesn't want to go because there's no reward in it. And so Conan, Zula, and Akira ride off. And then Malak hears the approaching sounds of the BDSM army and goes,
is that
well?
Is that leather on leather? You know, like, squeaking.
Oh, here they're coming. And a bit of mumbling from the zipped up gimp masks. Anyway, so they're riding off and we're moving into the climax of the film.
True.
But that's where we're going to leave you on this particular episode.
Yeah. Kyle, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Before we sign off, so Kyle writes film reviews.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Where can people see what you're up to?
Yeah, so I'm all my reviews show up at screenrex.com.
Spell that, because
at screenrex.com, like a T-Rex.
Okay.
I've got a great... Well, I think it's a great review of Dune Part 2 that's already up there.
Awesome.
For everyone to see and check out. Big Frank Herbert fan, so I've got a lot to say about that. Also, I have just finished the first draft of a fiction, work of fiction that I'm been tagging away at for the last year. So
nice.
A little bit of a horror junkie. So trying to put that into a book.
So keep your eyes out for any work from Kyle Pinion. And thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
We'll be back next week to take you across the finish line with Conan the Destroyer. Until then, we'll be back.